So what I was going to just talk about kind of briefly is that when we were thinking about this stuff, it was how do we, I mean, like others have already talked about, how do we create meaningful and horizontal and rethink solidarity between as people living and existing in the U.S. in all sorts of different positions, but how also do we engage with meaningful solidarity here or envision it here, and how has the older version also infected kind of what we experience here, you know? And just kind of like a lot of stuff people were talking about earlier, you know, as people went down to Latin America or went to other places in the world, and I'm talking now largely about like people with either class or race or education privilege, and came back here in the 1980s as a lot of shit was kind of coming down on movements across the global south. There was like a big, the emergence of the not-for-profit movement, right? It was kind of exploding all over the place. And there was also a lot of, you know, what people call kind of the new wave of immigrants, but really people of color immigrants coming from all over the global south, also a lot, basically due to like shit that the U.S. was doing or the World Bank was doing or other institutions were doing in a lot of places. And so as that started to happen, this immigrant rights movement kind of got named, even though it had existed for a really long time before that. People who were immigrants were organizing for a super long time, but it wasn't an isolated identity. You were an immigrant, you were also a mother, you were also a woman, you were also a worker, and you were a whole person. But within kind of that time period, it became an isolated thing. And people still had people-based immigrants, communities of immigrants organizing, but because of the whole not-for-profit model, those, you know, who outside of immigrant communities were often in leadership, and those not-for-profits were able to take, were able to dominate resources, dominate visibility, say, like, these are the people in need, right? And it was third world peoples, again, similar to the folks who had been visited before, right? But then kind of it seems like what happened was this image of the quote-unquote immigrant got painted also from like this revolutionary movement that you visited before to like somebody who was just this needy person, kind of in need, and oh, like I'm doing this for them, I'm teaching them their rights because who else can, right? So it wasn't really within a space of questioning power or privilege or who was doing what or who was speaking for who. And just that kind of carried out, continued this idea of solidarity here at home as creating, as perpetuating that idea of us and them, and who is them, and who is us, and who needs what, and well, we're here to serve, we're here to help, and yeah, it was good intention probably, and everything can be from the best of intentions, but what's the effects? And the effects was that it wasn't always people's stories who were at the center. I mean, and that's kind of, I mean, one of the things we do at the Center for Immigrant Families is begin from our migration stories, right? And not just when we came, but why we came, how we came, what we expected life to be like here, what we found. And from beginning with those stories, it's a really important healing process, but also an important political process, right? Because then our organizing emerges from people's stories. And it seems like if we're going to think about creating horizontal relationships, it needs to be rethinking kind of the structures and how we're organizing, not only, you know, and not only kind of tokenizing, putting people's, you know, the most affected voices at the center, people of color at the center, low-income people at the center, but really rethinking our daily practices. Because, I mean, it's really about kind of one of the things that seems to have been created through not being able to create like a we that really is about looking at power and privilege, but a we, you know, that's not just reliant on us and them and how can I teach them English or how can I do this for them, you know. But, you know, at CIF, one of the projects that we have going on is a project around kind of taking back the public schools in an increasingly gentrified neighborhood. And one of the things that we confront in that particular neighborhood is that a lot of people who are kind of trying to create kind of private institutions out of public schools, and will say, well, you know, I can't be racist because I marched down south, you know, in the civil rights movement or blah, blah, blah. And it can't, and so there's this inability to say, well, what are my daily actions? How are my kids being raised? What are my expectations for my child? Or like beyond my 9-to-5 job, how am I actually seeking to integrate all these principles into all of our daily practices? And so I feel like it's not only for some people, but it's for all of us to think about, you know, where we buy our vegetables, how we raise our children, what kind of practices we integrate into our daily experiences, so we can really create a we that's powerful, that's united and acting out of each of our own positions and prioritizing the leadership of those most affected by shit, whether that's folks in the global south or immigrants in this country, you know, or other people of color in this country. So yeah, I guess that's just one thing.
So building off of what folks here have been talking a lot about, I'm going to actually focus on the first step to building that kind of solidarity that we've been talking about and that we're envisioning, which is based on mutuality and sharing and a genuine and full understanding that our different struggles from our different locations are interdependent and connected to each other. Oh, sorry. As I said, so one way that we begin that process is through self-reflection, and that isn't necessarily to imply that it's an individualistic exercise, but it's something that we can engage in collectively through dialogue, through spaces like this one, where we can come together to talk about and reflect on who we are, where we've been, what we've done, and how, as people who are trying to engage in meaningful solidarity work. And I think that for a lot of us, there's uneasiness around that process, and not just in activist spaces or organizing spaces, but also in many aspects of our lives where, you know, when we talk about or mention needing to engage in reflection and coming together, that, you know, for many of us, we hear that that's a luxury that we can't afford because we're in a battle right now. We're engaged in battle and we're in crisis mode and, you know, we have to confront the day-to-day challenges and issues that the communities we're a part of are facing. And the thing is that it doesn't necessarily mean, like, taking time out, or maybe it does, like somebody was saying earlier, that there can be a commitment to a long-term process if that's what you need to do to get everything, you know, to just get things going, but that process, as has already been mentioned, can be something that you engage in on a day-to-day as you live your daily life. And I think also what's important to highlight or to admit is that checking part of that reflection process is needing to check yourself, which is really, it's really a difficult thing to do because it involves looking at everything and everyone and your relation to others, your relation to what you're fighting to change and your relation to what you're struggling to create. So it basically involves all of our baggage and thinking, and particularly thinking about our identities and our positions that we occupy in this society, whether as people of color, working class folks, activists in the U.S., et cetera, whatever identity we subscribe to. And it's from those different locations we can make a movement, because oftentimes I think there's a hesitancy or reluctance to focus on difference, because then how do we have a unified political agenda? And I think that to have that unified entity that I think we're all, as folks who are living in the U.S., are trying to achieve, that you have to start from the different positions that you're located in, and to be honest about what those positions are. I think that, I mean, and specifically for folks who are engaged in radical social change, that radical social change can't just be about what's out there, like I think somebody else already mentioned, but has to start internally within ourselves and also within our own community. Because, you know, just in focusing on this particular context that we're living here in the United States, that comes with, that brings with it a whole set of values and norms, institutions that that we were born into, that we were raised with, and that we have to challenge ourselves. I mean, just as a side note, I mean, I as a member of the collective of Center for Immigrant Families, to be part of a collective, I mean, that was a really big transition, because I had been, I was raised here in the United States and had always subscribed to this hierarchical ascending, you start here and then you work your way up, that vertical model that, also implies that you have to, that you may have to step on others to go up the rungs of success, however that's been defined in the mainstream. And being part of the collective, that's been like a daily checking myself, am I going out of process? What is process? And it actually has been a really meaningful and powerful transition, because, it has really required learning how to be a different way in the world. Learning how to be a different way in the world, which is really different for all of us, because it is coming from where we stand, and even where we stand often fluctuates and changes. Folks who were in the Global South 10 years ago and are here now, that's a different position. Folks who just got here, and especially now, living in the time that we do with all the with the anti-immigrant legislation and climate, folks are in a different position. So we can't even, as those of us living in the United States, can't even talk about a uniform privilege that we have. But so I think that in some ways, I wonder if we can talk about solidarity, because for me that's actually about relationships and the different relationships that we have based on our lives and the relationships that we build and where we are. And I think that that's one way to begin thinking about how our struggles are actually connected, because we can be honest about what those struggles individually are and then see what the points of connection in order to move forward and begin breaking that us versus them dynamic, which folks had also talked about. And ultimately, again, just to reiterate, work towards solidarity that genuinely is based on mutuality and sharing and reflection, and from that, a commitment to nurture and support each other while still being cognizant of the different positions and privileges that we may occupy within that relationship.
Hi, so my name is RJ, and I think maybe originally how I ended up here, maybe we all work together in different ways. I wrote a piece in the most recent issue about the Zapatistas, and I was there originally reporting for a group called Narco News, which does online reporting. And I think that was really important work. There's not a lot of people that are really doing kind of grassroots reporting, especially in English, about the new things that are going on in Mexico. But that's not really what I'm going to talk about tonight. First, though, I want to shout out. I have four coworkers in the audience tonight, and I'm really excited about that. There's Amanda, Belen, Ace, and Jose. And we work for a nonprofit. We do education stuff, and it's exciting for me that they're in the room tonight. And also, we are trying to figure out what to do inside our nonprofit, right? How do we organize? How do you organize a nonprofit? I did union organizing, but not like this. it's totally different. That's something that's really exciting me tonight, is this, that's happening. And I sort of was radicalized after the new movements. I was radicalized. I didn't know about the Zapatistas until like 1999. And sort of was radicalized apart by that struggle and seeing that struggle happen from a distance. And also a lot of my early kind of political formation was a really like massive dose of anti-oppression analysis and people really going hard at looking at white supremacy and patriarchy and heterosexism and some shit that was really devastating for me. Because I think when I first started thinking about things that fucked up, I want to change the world, I imagine myself as an individual. I think I started an organization that I was in charge of. I didn't even have basic conceptions in my head about how to really build anything that didn't have me at the center of it. Because like Priscilla was saying, I mean, you know, it's weird almost because I was raised by a single mother. I was going to schools where most of my peers were black, right? It's not like I even, but it didn't matter. Like I was still locked into that notion that, or maybe even more so because of that. Maybe because I felt like I was going to do the rags to riches thing, right? And then it was just transferred into the movement, right? Like now I'm just going to be like something in the movement, like a leader or a hero or something. Talking to a lot of friends, I mean, I think that happens to a lot of us. We bring all that shit with us when we decide that we want to change the world. And so getting hit with all this analysis around white supremacy and patriarchy and my heterosexism and all these things was a devastating experience. I went from thinking I was the shit to thinking I ain't shit. And so, but even when I was totally broken down, you know, and I was just like, I can't do anything. I'm worthless. You know, which, I mean, really, you know? I knew that I wanted to change. I knew that something needed to change. And so, it was sort of like figuring out what to do now. And something I learned from that other big influence, which was the Zapatistas, was to listen. And so I stopped the stuff I was doing and I just started listening. And we're still involved in different struggles and stuff. I was always listening and looking for some responses to my dilemma, I guess, which I realized like a lot of people face. And what I eventually started to realize was I found that the most radical, most holistic sort of analyses around what was going on in the United States were coming from women of color, right? And I was reading Angela Davis, right? And starting to hear about what Insight was doing, which is a group of women of color against violence that does all sorts of stuff, doing the analysis around the nonprofit industrial complex, tying in the stuff that Angela Davis and other people in critical resistance were talking about with the prison system, with interpersonal violence. And so as I was listening, I was hearing these voices, and these were the voices that, for me, started to hit me in a way that other things that had not really hit me. For example, I think that Chomsky is amazing, and I think that he can really break things down. But I never really felt like I was in a room with him. You know, like I never really felt like I couldn't really feel him. You know, and I felt like maybe his book was more useful on the shelf when I needed to pull out that statistic and hit somebody with what happened 40 years ago and how that ties into today, but it wasn't really giving me any direction. And so, coming from Cincinnati, which is where I'm from, we were the Cincinnati Zapatista Coalition, right? And we were trying to figure out how to be Zapatistas in our community. And Cincinnati is really segregated. And, you know, I don't even want to say there's a lot of police brutality because that's kind of stupid. There is a lot of police brutality everywhere. But for whatever reason, we were really seeing it. And so we were starting to organize around that. And we weren't just white folks. We were black, white, indigenous folks, a lot of different folks in the group, and we were trying to figure out how to do things. So we were doing stuff around police brutality, we were trying to figure out what's the indigenous struggle in Cincinnati, where there's not even territories that we could identify. And we started linking up with the powwows. And we started finding out that there was a movement against the mascots, so the Cleveland Indians. So whenever the Cleveland Indians would come and play in Cincinnati, we would do something there. And we were getting into the global justice stuff. And so we were organizing around, there was a global justice summit in Cincinnati. We organized around that. We were starting to do things and starting to try and figure out what to do. And at the same time, a lot of times our groups would like shatter a lot because the guys would still be doing too much patriarchal shit. And then all of a sudden we find out that women don't want to work with us anymore. Right? Or there was like, for me, I had a mentor for me was a black woman from my neighborhood who was an anarchist. Years before I even knew what an anarchist was, we were peers. And one of the things that really knocked me like totally out of this world was when she said she did not want to work with me anymore. And that was one of those experiences that really... And all of this is going on while we're still organizing the global justice protests, while we're organizing the anti-mascot stuff. All these things are happening at the same time. And all were a part of that process. That was all of our processes. And I did some union organizing, and then I eventually followed my girlfriend in New York City. And was trying to figure out what to do here. And I think the really privileged thing about being in New York City is that that Ashanti lives here, really. No, and Eric and Paola and Dana and Priscilla, everybody, right? Like, there's a lot of people here that I would never have met in Cincinnati. And when we talk about going back to Cincinnati, and maybe we will, maybe we won't, but I think I was exposed to things here. And, alright. I think we should all be abolitionists. I think that the notion of safety and security dominates the U.S. discourse. And so in the same way that the Zapatistas take Zapata, right? They are digging at the roots of Mexico. I think if we start to dig at the roots of the United States, we have to talk about the abolitionists. We have to talk about the struggle against slavery. And I think that it's still with us. We're still every day bombarded with these notions of safety and security. And that abolitionist analysis today is one that cuts that to pieces and starts to say, no, this everything this is built on is the demonization of Africans, the demonization of indigenous people, of Chinese folks, Mexican folks, all these things. You start to find out this whole fucking structure, the prison industrial complex, and the whole structure that allows for military excursions is built on this notion of punitive justice and this notion of security that can only be achieved through this punitive justice. So I think whatever work we're doing, I don't think people have to join critical resistance, but I think people can really take into our analysis an abolitionist perspective. I would really recommend a really brief brochure thing that Angela Davis put out a couple years ago about it. Does anyone remember the... Yeah, Our Prison's Obsolete. It's a really short, sweet primer. She's got a big book coming out, but I don't think I'm going to read it. But I read the pamphlet. It's really good. But also lately, it's funny getting back to my roots, thinking about, my mother was really radical in a lot of ways. Like, getting back to that lately, I've been doing a lot of childcare. And something I would encourage a lot of people in this room is to work with the childcare collective that Radhika, who's here, and myself, and some other people, Patrick, are starting to organize. It's not like a men's ally thing. It's not a white people ally thing. Anyone that thinks you should be doing childcare within this movement and partnering with radical women of color organizations, radical mothers, if you think you should be doing that, if you think that might be a good thing to do, talk to us, because we want you. We want to work with you.
All right, so I just want to give everyone a round of applause and all y'all. Can you make some noise? And so right now I just wanted to, in the time we have left, to put it out to everyone here and ask you some questions. So I'm going to take a few questions and then shoot it back to these folks and to respond, to whatever you guys feel inspired to.
any thoughts?
Yeah, I'll speak up. I'm Elder Haleem Gullah Bimi. I'm from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm an elder in the Gullah Geechee Nation. And the Gullah Geechee Nation is about preserving and protecting the our heritage, our culture, and our existence in the southeastern portion of the United States. Gullah Geechee Nation exists from Cape Fear, North Carolina, all the way down to Jacksonville, Florida, 30 miles inland. And I would say, to talk about solidarity in the context of self-determination, which I haven't heard here tonight. And self-determination only means that you have a right to self-determination, a human right to self-determination, to determine how you are to live your life. And in that right, not a privilege, I understand what you mean by American have privileges and so forth, but you, above all that, it has been international, the community has ratified the right to self-determination, including the United States of America. So it's just something that you do. And I would say that that's what rethinking means to me. And and to understand the political model, where we fit in politically, and understand about the shifts and the real power and so forth. But political, and everything is political. Not everyone has a culture. And for me, self-determination means that if you don't have a culture, get together with those who do have one. And become their friends and become a
citizen.
Hi,
I'm Mitchell Cohen, and I from New Smyrna, he's been with the Greens. And I really appreciated a lot of the thoughts that was put out here. And I'd like to, there's one thing, though, that sort of bugs me a little bit, and that's the idea that that came from some of the speakers, that we're still doing things for others, even though other speakers didn't do that. I see it that we're, you know, there's a certain Christian approach that of self-martyrdom, of sacrifice, that we're not in it for ourselves as well. And and I think Dana pointed out really well, that inter-dynamic between what we're doing with others, for ourselves and for the world. And once we lose that, and we say we're doing it for others, even then we lose that whole, we become liberals. You know, no matter how militant we are, we're just liberals. So, in that context, there are all sorts of issues. Everybody has a culture. We all have culture. We all have roots. We all have issues that we're organizing around. And as folks put it out, how do we link them up? To me, that's a key thing. How do we intersect them so that we don't only link up separate issues, but I peel back the layers of the issues that I'm working on to find those issues that others are working on within it. And like I'm doing stuff, I'll just give one or two examples. Doing stuff around cell phone towers now, right? An issue that nobody really talks about. Yet the people who are really in Brooklyn, there are two main areas where there's cell phone towers in Crown Heights and in Bay Ridge, in parts of different communities, where there's like 28 cell phone towers on one building. You know, and everybody in the building has cancer or neurological disease and things like that. Now that should be an issue. People came to us, they don't know how to organize. They never organized anything in their life. Where do I go? Where do I turn? Who do I talk to? You know, and that's something that we link up with other, you know, we need to link that up somehow and bring people into that struggle to understand, you know, to peel back again, to peel back the layers of that struggle, to see the white supremacist dimension of it, the patriarchal dimension to it, and the environmental dimension to it. So that's, and I think we need to do that with every issue. And I'd like to maybe, if people could talk specifically about some of the issues that we're actually working on as well as this general framework, I think that would be really helpful.
Okay, the woman sitting.
Hi, so a question I had, but I know you talked, some of the members of the panel talked about learning about the movement in other countries and how they're doing things differently than a lot of the organizations here in the U.S. I just wondered what types of examples did you get and how you're going to use that in your way of doing it when you start working on it.
My question is, I'm proud of the movement of solidarity movement in El Salvador. But I have seen the situation that happened in El Salvador, and I can see the situation in Mexico and what happened here in the United States. And I sort of agree with some people who said that solidarity is something that is to live in a communion where everybody shares with the same difference and similarity. But I have two problems that I put here there. One is in terms of the problem that I can see the division of different nationalism, to put it in a simple way. Okay? That's one of the problems because here, while sort of you are struggling to support open solidarity with part of the world, then there's another problem in another part of the world. So that's one of the issues that I can see here. Well, if you could see that this issue is not just something that affects the Zapatistas because they're descendants, they're Aztec or Mayan or whomever, but it also affects people who are part of the working class. The class that I think is international to begin with, that shouldn't have borders. Because, I mean, let's face it, which country in the world doesn't have borders? So, that's the thing that I think is, I didn't need to deny it and would like to see. So, instead of that, I think it doesn't matter where we are, in which industry we are working, we have more in common with other workers, anywhere else, than with, I have to say, are different. Because, like the immigrant movement right now, for instance, I mean, we can see two problems right there. Now, there's a lot of people from Mexico with Mexican and U.S. flags, which is a big anger to me. On one hand, they join the nationalism that exists in that country, and I don't know whether nationalism is something negative. And on the other hand, it's united in the hands of the class that has the control in the United States. And therefore, they will be, whenever they get citizenship, they will be easier to be recruited, sent to the army, and then, therefore, sent to fight for that.
All right, thanks for that.
Thank you.
So why don't we, let's take one more and then go back to the speaker.
So Left Turn has done a lot of really good coverage of the anti-war movement. And one of the things I haven't heard tonight is any comments or questions around what the question of solidarity means in terms of Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe Iran, and who knows where else. Mm-hmm. And I work for the Boys Institute League, we do a lot of organizing here in the States within the anti-war movement. One of the things we haven't tackled is what it means to actually be in solidarity with people of Iraq. Mm-hmm. And there's been some sort of sectarian lines put out there that seem pretty hollow to me. So I'm curious what you folks think, what your experience would teach you about solidarity in the anti-war movement and also with folks in Iraq, Afghanistan, and where else.
All right.
Maybe on that question of the war, I think that's a really important question. Actually, when we wrote the piece that's in Left Turn, one of the questions to the writers was, what is the first thing that we need to do, one of our main tasks in the war came to mind. It's a difficult sell to talk about the hemispheric strategy around, at least I'm speaking for myself here, for me it's a difficult sell to talk about that while this war is happening. When we think about what our priorities are, I wonder if instead of thinking of how we do intercommunal solidarity with Latin America, we should really be focusing the next, you know, at least 2 years until the this administration passes, 2.5 years on the war. So I think it's an important question. I wonder, though, whether or not, as RJ put it, there is some listening we need to do around the leadership that's coming out of this hemisphere around the Venezuela, the Cuba, the Brazil kind of axis, whether or not there's some leadership coming out of those voices down there that might be instructive around how we, on the one hand, uphold these movements, celebrate them, but then also keep our eyes on this other prize, which is ending the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to, I think that there are a lot of interesting questions raised, but not to move the other ones, just to touch quickly on that as well. I also feel very deeply that, like, a critical task of our movements in the U.S. is to work on ending the war in Iraq, and to specifically target the occupations that exist, but in Iraq, Palestine, Afghanistan, et cetera. But I also, I guess I would say that I don't see that as being distinct from the argument that our primary task is to organize locally, and I think that some of the most exciting work that I've seen the anti-war movement take on has been organizing that's focused on military families and organizing that has been focusing on counter-recruitment work and particularly kind of the communities that are most targeted for military recruitment, and has been organizing people on local issues within the framework of how that's connected to kind of military spending and things like that. And I feel like, you know, what ultimately is going to end the war is going to be the capacity to stop it from those kind of feeding points. I don't think that it's such a distinction that we need to adhere to, that, you know, you can work on the war in Iraq or you can organize locally, and that, you know, oppressed communities in the U.S. aren't going to be focusing on that. In fact, that's the critical juncture of, you know, who's really impacted by that war. And so, you know, I see that as coming together very much.
Kind of connecting that point, I felt like the first two questions, I think there were some, there was a link there. The brother from South Carolina, I thought that was a really important point, the question of self-determination. And then your point around nationalism and capitalism and capitalism as a kind of like homogeneous force that in some way can link us, if we look at it in that perspective. And I think for me, one of the things that's really, really inspiring about what people are talking about, the movements that are coming out of Latin America now, is this emphasis on autonomy, which I think is a similar word to self-determination, and that kind of like, but not just as like a simple, you know, concept, but really having us think about all the ways that we're invested in this system in terms of where we bank, you know, the money we spend on oil, the taxes that we're paying, the amount of money we spend buying new stuff, you know, all these ways, and what would it mean to create our lives in a way that we are truly disinvesting from this society and building something new. I mean, that's what people are doing, you know, in these movements, in many of these movements. And for, if we were able to start to imagine, I mean, I think there's a way in which it can be so overwhelming that we don't take the leap of imagination, and not just like into some kind of like hippie commune thing that some people are doing it, but how can we do it in a way that is really linked to our communities and that is relevant to our communities, you know? I think that if we can start to do that, then we also get at this issue that you're bringing up in terms of like what the solidarity, how can we really start stop this war? Well, how can we stop funding the war? How can we stop paying tax dollars that are funding this war? You know, how can, beyond just it being some random thing that a few people are doing, you know? Um, So they're definitely in the way, you know, and I'm not saying this from a place of, oh, well, I have figured out, talk to me, and, you know, but really, like, what would it mean from, you know, can I start to build something with people where we stop buying shit? Can we do that? Like, can we really stop buying, or at least new stuff? and can we start to create networks where we can truly start to disinvest from this, from the society, because that would create an impact, you know.
I think kind of connected to what you were saying, Ozla, and what others were saying too, I think that it's also, I feel like, for me, about not thinking that, right, because, I mean, they've come out publicly, the government's come out publicly and said, this is like a generations-long war, and so it's beyond Iraq, it's beyond Afghanistan, it's beyond Palestine, right? It's a proactive shit that they have in their heads, and so how do we build our shit for the longer term is really through organizing strong communities of resistance here, right, locally. And I think, like, part of it's also just connected to, I mean, I think one thing that it seems like we really have to catch up with is what you were talking about, Ajwa, also, like, you know, I mean, I think in other parts of, like, you know, in Europe, wherever, people just, like, ask on a daily basis, right, where is this vegetable from? Is it from Israel? Because that's a place where vegetables get brought in from. So asking about not just is it from Iraq, but is, you know, is this shit made in a sweatshop, or how is shit made, you know? And so integrating that into our practice and just thinking about then what are the local conditions of the war on communities here too, you know, how are people being deported? How are people being criminalized? How does this immigration law hook up with kind of the war on Iraq and the conditions abroad, and how do we take actions locally and build shit just really strong so that it can't be a four-generation, five-generation war like they're saying, you know?
So I got Shanti, Kala, and RJ, and then we got a sister over here that's going to make a brief announcement. I just wanted, before we go, and we'll probably, you know, in about 15 minutes or so, we'll wrap this up. I know it's getting late. For people that, you know, need to get out of here or whatever, just a real quick pitch to get the magazine, the new issue, like, turned in the back. T-shirts, we're not trying to take this stuff home with us, you know what I'm saying? Just, like, whatever you can do. We're completely funded, literally, by readers, by events, by, you know, donations, small donations by people. So just, you know what I'm saying, put that out there and to pick up the issue in the back. Ashanti.
Mine is probably directed more towards around self-determination and the nationalism, but I think I can best speak on it in terms of my experience, why I wanted to go to Chiapas and check out this opportunity. I've been in this since 13, 14 years old. Black liberation, black power, self-determination for black people. That's my number one concern. For me, that makes me a nationalist to this day. Even though most of us know I'm an anarchist, I'm still both of them. If it's contradiction, that's okay. But it's just that my nationalism is not about grabbing the nation state. It's about helping to create the conditions so black people can be free. Knowing that that means that the empire's got to fall. So, of course, we got to figure out how to do that. Solidarity becomes very important within the empire here, within the frame here. But me going to the Zapatistas was searching for ways of how can this happen here in my circumstances, what my fight is about. You see, the Zapatistas, who are basically Mayan people, brown people of Mexico, take the lead. Not the vanguard of this, but just take the lead because of the circumstances of the struggle that they have to come forward and not try to capture state power, but say they're going to create conditions, they want to create the space for other people to come into the picture to figure out how to make a new kind of revolution. I'm like, that's for me here. That's for me. I got to figure out. Every day in my community, I see the devastation. Right? But I know that when there comes time for a black liberation army, I know what a lot of white radicals and liberals are going to do. Because I know what happened before. I know what white workers are going to do. I know what workers are going to do. I mean, and that is regardless of their color. Because that's what the American working class does. All right, people want to take that and change that, and I hope you can do it. But it makes me feel so desperate sometimes. And I hold to my nationalism because I see what's happening to black folks. Even when we can't get the support that we need from our white allies and others. Right? The situation that just happened in Durham, North Carolina, the black woman who got raped by the lacrosse team, whatever. You know, and all of it, the prison industrial complex, this is hitting us. I need to focus on what's happening to our folks. But it is that I am so happy that I have relationships with other folks that represent other communities and other struggles. Because we can talk about the mistakes that were made in the past and what we might need to do next. There are political prisoners that have been in there for 30, some 40 years. You know, and it's like, I cannot do anything but focus on that. But I know what's going to happen when other folks through the underground go get them the same way they did the South. The folks are going to back up from us. But this is our lives. We're facing genocidal shit. So we got to rethink this stuff. We cannot just act like some old formula from the past is just going to work. Or that in us not only rethinking but beginning to practice new forms of solidarity, that we're not going to be challenged in other areas of our life that we never assumed, and which was RJ's story. You're going to be challenged. I'm challenged. The heterosexism, the sexism, the ageism, all that stuff, because that's what revolution does. You have an opportunity now to change your whole life. And yeah, it's going to be difficult. But I know for me, priority number one is my focus. Number one. No way, I don't even try to. Then, how can we do this together? So that never again do black people, indigenous folks, do even workers have to face this class society, this racist society, this genocidal society. We can go create something new. So my nationalism stays, just takes on a different form because it's being formed by so many other different things now.
I think that there was a lot of interesting comments and questions, and one that we didn't really address from a sister over here about, so if we're talking about horizontal solidarity and learning, so what are some concrete shit we've learned and what are some concrete shit we've tried, right? And I feel like it's one of the hardest questions to answer. So I guess I can throw out a couple of things that's helpful and also a little bit of thinking about why it's so hard. But I know that for the work that I've been a part of in AJWA, part of the same organization as the sister, we were doing work with as young Black and Latina women in Bushwick around police sexual abuse and police violence against young women, which is a huge issue that now, years later, comes out in all the papers about these cops that finally got busted, right? And so we were doing kind of organizing campaigns, and we were doing kind of like... Both the police were what they were doing, direct action, you know, documentation, and this campaign against our local precinct to hold them accountable or change something. And we kind of hit a wall of like, well, what is the demand? What are we going to ask them to change? How could we be any better? Like, is there anything they could do that we would feel like they want in this kind of U.S. community organizing format? That you have to have a clear target, clear demands, a winnable goal, and an issue specific that you work on, right? It didn't work, you know? And so for us, I think we learned a lot around these creating communities of autonomy, thinking that it's not about toppling state power, but cracking it in small little ways till it crumbles. And that's really what's going to happen. And that for us, as opposed to focusing our energy on this precinct and these cops, who then retaliated against us in crazy ways, we said, yo, let's think from these other examples and try to create a kind of a liberated territory for our community where we don't turn to the cops for any form of violence, any kind of dispute. We're trying to create community accountability and divest from them altogether, right? It's called Sisters Liberated Ground, has all these beautiful components, and it's been a huge struggle, and you know, a few years later, we're still like in part
sub-A-A-1, you know? But it's a vision of thinking beyond, even though I appreciate, you know, you asking us to be more specific on our work, and I think that's cool, but it isn't necessarily cutting it at this issue you work on and this issue you work on, right? Learning that people are working beyond, they don't cut themselves in issues, you know, and they're not thinking about it in a campaign in that way. So I think being able to bring that mode of work is really helpful in whatever thing that we're doing. And so blah blah. And why it feels so hard to really do that, kind of what Aj was saying, is we're so in it ourselves. We're living it. It's inside us. And when we're trying to think about how we could divest or create autonomy, we're so much more invested, you know, in the empire than a lot of these folks we're learning from. That's how we can learn from them, because they are further away and not so caught up and, like, entangled. But we are. And so it's like we have this internalized, you know, imperialism and capitalism inside each one of us that doesn't allow us to just do what I was saying in a way of, like, oh, you know, we can just say, you know what, we won't shop there anymore, we won't eat there, we're kind of like just focus on each other and trust each other that we can do that. So these practical solidarity things that we saw in Argentina, the recuperated factory movement, where it isn't even about having political gatherings, but like, y'all are going to take over the hotel, we took over the tile factory, we'll give y'all tiles for your hotel, when we go to that city, we need to sleep somewhere, so we'll sleep in your hotel. And it's very concrete, it's tangible, we're doing actual things, and political work is not just in your brain, but it's in your hands, and you have to do it every day, and it's survival, you know? So I feel like, to me, that's how that practice comes out here is not how to not be a hippie commune is unlearning our internalized capitalism as we do it.
So did y'all?
Hi, my name is John. I'm from an organization called the Global Board for Pan Community Development. And I'd like to thank the organizers for giving us time to speak. Especially because I think the framework of the discussion was a little bit different than what we were about to talk about. This is we're kind of like trying to ask for solidarity because we have in the past month we've been thinking about like what salary means to us in terms of like what happens when the movement of third world wants to come to the US to take on the stuff that's happening here. Because US and South Korea have announced that they will begin talks on a free trade agreement between the two countries. And the first round of talks will begin in June. And there's about 500 people coming from South Korea to Washington D.C. to protest and then try to disrupt the talks. And the FTA between South Korea and the U.S. will be the biggest free trade agreement that the U.S. will sign since the North American Free Trade Agreement. And we all know what happened with North American Free Trade Agreement. And just like Mexico's local economy has been practically destroyed, we fear that same thing will happen to South Korea's economy, and especially with 15 million workers that have fought hard to gain workers' rights. They're going to be turned over to like what's happening worldwide, what we saw almost happen in France, and what we see happening in the United States, which is that their work is being their worker status is turned over from permanent status to temporary status. So they're going to be the 15 million workforce. So the 15 million workers in South Korea are going to become contingent workers within a matter of months. And also with the agriculture, about the 3.5 million farmers in South Korea will practically become either independent workers or will become the urban poor, because what will happen is the shipping force from the U.S. will destroy our local agriculture and lose all our self-sufficiency. But also at the center of this, the U.S. strategy to, at the center of the U.S. economic strategy is exploiting or tapping into markets in China and India, which has like the biggest population, which means that it has the biggest workforce to produce goods that we consume in the first world.
Is there something specific, right, that's coming up that you guys want to put that out there?
Okay. So we're trying to mobilize people in D.C. We're planning a big rally on June 4th, it's a Sunday, in Washington, D.C. And then also there will be events throughout the week talking about international politics. So we're hoping to pass on the ship to... For people that might be interested, if you could give us your name and your contact info, we could send out more information about that.
Where's the sheet? Sorry, it really makes it. Was add something until 8:30,
And while they're spending around that sheet, I got someone who just wanted to do a quick addition to that.
We can talk as well, because I'm from Malaysia and my country is also just announcing intent to sign a free trade agreement with the US. But I've worked on free trade agreements before. Apart from people in DC, I don't know anyone else in the US, people based in the US, who are actively willing to campaign on free trade agreements related to Asia. I know there's plenty of stuff in Latin America, but as far as Asia goes, I haven't seen a lot of activity. So I'd be open to anybody.
I think U.S. is actually to get into markets and markets in China and India. U.S. is trying to is actively negotiating free trade agreements with countries like South Korea, countries like Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia. These are the countries that are surrounding India and China.
So I'm gonna let folks just make final announcements for stuff. I know there's a few things coming up, and or if there's anything like, you know, that anyone up here that really wanted to get out, just to wrap it up, and just thank everybody again for coming.
So I was serious when I said I want to work with some of you in a childcare collective, and we're having a get together on Sunday here, noon to 3. And you know that Liz Messages, right?
Yeah.
Talk to Liz Roberts. Radhika, who's right there, is holding up little sheets of paper. So if it's not you, but it's somebody you know, still take one, please. And a lot of the mothers that we work with are really stressed, and they'd like to see a lot of men of color in our organization. So especially give a nudge to your friends that are men of color that might want to do this kind of work. And come here on Sunday at 12.
Is this an announcement?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
I wanted the grandmothers to attend the Peace Brigade for the rest of the
year.
I want to tell you that it's going to be in court this Thursday, the 100th anniversary. Cindy Sheehan will be there. And we'd like as many people who can to come and support us at 8:30 in the morning. If you're going to come, just to be in at the trial tonight. But if you can come, it's good.
What day?
This Thursday. 100th Center Street Support Center.
And just a personal plug, then, if no one else is going to make one.
Go ahead.
Everybody, there's an amazing anti-war documentary playing right now at the IFC Theater. It's called Sir, No Sir. It's going to be playing for 1 week from Wednesday till next Tuesday. It's about the untold story of the GI resistance movement inside the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. And if you go there during the evening showings next week, the director will be there, as well as a few of the anti-war vets who are organizing right now. surrounding rock. So.
I'll try to make this quick. I'm working on a project called Operation Refuse War, which is bringing together conscientious objectors from around the world to meet with COs here in the U.S. in the middle of May. We're having a small strategy summit here at the Brex, and part of that is going to be a public panel happening on Thursday, May 11th, looking at conscientious objection as an international strategy to build an anti-war movement that takes into account all the stuff about pulling ourselves out of the machine. I'm really pleased to take part. So I want to encourage you all to join us during that. We're also having a conference in D.C. that weekend. OperationRefuseWar.org is the website. And I'd love to talk to all y'all about how to get involved in that.
Connect.
Just really fast. I'm working with Estación Libre, and I just wanted to plug, we're trying to fundraise money because we have a tour, a speaking tour that some folks are here. They're going to be participating on, and to help fundraise that, there's some silkscreen posters if anyone's interested. They're like on print. So, you know, interpersonal relationships, so we can fundraise to work that we do and y'all can have some aesthetic things to like have around and try to have the